He has been called, and it's particularly appropriate for this group perhaps, the most celebrated monk since Martin Luther. And he has been called a symbol of our century, a man for our times. But what does all this really mean when we come to look at the experience of Thomas Merton? I think there are seven areas that I would list in which he has had quite a profound influence on our time. This is in the formation of ideas, or as Archbishop Jadot said in the documentary, Thomas Merton was the kind of prophet who didn't necessarily open new ways, but reminded us of ways we might have forgotten. These seven areas, some of which I'll be able to touch upon today and some of which I may not, in which I think he has been influential, are in the idea of unity or wholeness. One of the most quoted lines of Thomas Merton is, "There is in all things a hidden wholeness." And eventually Merton was able to see a wholeness in everything. God's creation as a wholeness into which we must fit. The idea of self-awareness. Merton's experience, as he wrote about it and told us about it, was usually put in terms of a journey or a quest. And he felt that this journey on which all of us must embark is really to discover our true self, or our real self, as he sometimes put it. I think in this area of self-awareness, this idea of a journey to know the self, Merton has had great impact on our time. And certain social areas, of course, the issues of war and peace, he did have profound impact. In church reform, within his own Catholic Church, he was undoubtedly influential. In social justice, areas of civil rights and so forth. In transcultural consciousness, raising the level of our awareness about cultures other than our own, which themselves have integrity and dignity, and which, if we can see it, may be used to enrich our own traditions. Inclusiveness, and by this I mean not only women, but young people. Although certainly with women, it took a long time on Thomas Merton's journey for him to feel comfortable with women or to have very successful relationships, even friendly relationships with women. So I think in these seven areas, he has had an impact in our time. Okay. Thomas Merton couched his experience in terms of a journey, and he used the image of the mountain, usually in talking about this journey, or many times in talking about this journey. The idea that we are all trying to scale a mountain, trying to get to the top of the mountain. His most famous work, The Seven-Story Mountain, the title taken from Dante's Seven Circles of Purgatory, bears out this image. And of course, the authorized biography, which I mentioned yesterday, has been titled The Seven Mountains of Thomas Merton, taking one actual physical mountain in each stage of his life that the biographer which the biographer chose to divide the biography as a major step along the way of Thomas Merton's journey. The first part of his journey was in getting, of course, to the Abbey of Gethsemane, and maybe I should back up a little bit before that and say to conversion. This is basically the story he tells us about in the Seven-Story Mountain. Thomas Merton, in the Seven-Story Mountain, told a story which definitely fits in to the mainstream of American cultural history. The Seven Story Mountain is a confessional autobiography. A man is telling us what has gone on within himself, which has led him to find Christ and God, which has led him to find what he feels is the answer for himself. Americans have always liked this kind of confessional autobiography, from the days of the Puritan experience onward. Many of the Puritans were much given to confessional, very personal narratives about themselves. Anne Bradstreet, the Mathers, both Increase and Cotton, Jonathan Edwards. This is something that definitely was present at the beginning of our intellectual and cultural history. And it has continued with us on through today. Americans like to read about other people's lives, particularly when these people seem to be confessing something or bearing their souls. To bring it to a more mundane level, perhaps, than Thomas Merton, the recent furor over Bette Davis, when her daughter bared her soul about how horrible her mother had been to her. Americans take to this sort of thing. It's the sort of thing that sells the National Enquirer, and so forth. So from that standpoint, the publishers probably didn't have to have much worry about the Seven Story Mountain selling copies in 1948, because Americans do like this sort of thing. And the climate in 1948 was particularly ripe for this kind of spiritual journey, confessional type story of someone who seemed in that post-war world to have found an answer. Americans were weary at that period of time. The 20th century had not been an easy time to live through, either for most Americans or for Thomas Merton. And in that way, his own experience reflected something of the general experience of the society in which he lived. We had been through two world wars, one world war, then a worldwide depression, and then the most destructive war in human history. And Americans at this point in time, as most social historians are pointing out, were searching for some kind of answer. And the books in 1948, not only the Seven Story Mountain, but others that were bestsellers in that period, indicate that Americans were looking for answers, religious and spiritual answers. The best-selling nonfiction book when The Seven Story Mountain was published was Dale Carnegie's How to Stop Worrying and Start Living, which in its own way was a how-to book. The Seven Story Mountain was interpreted by many people as a how-to book on how to find a spiritual answer, on how to develop one's spirituality. And of course, it was in its time a smash bestseller. As I said yesterday, The Seven Story Mountain put Thomas Merton on the map. It made him an international celebrity. This was a source of some embarrassment to him. Though his life journey may have been a journey to find his real self and to resolve contradictions, he says in many places that we must attempt to resolve contradictions, but we also must learn to live with the contradictions within ourselves if we're ever going to find ourselves really. And one of the contradictions, I think, in Merton always was he had this compulsion to write. He was always writing. Writing apparently was not just a means of expression to him. It was a way of living, almost. And when he wasn't writing formal essays, he was writing in his diary, or later he was writing letters, or writing poetry. So on the one hand, he constantly had this urge to write. And on the other hand, he constantly had an equally strong urge to be silent and to live in solitude. Now, there's obviously something egocentric about anybody who writes. Most of us who write don't do it so that it will just sit there and not be read. So though Thomas Merton was perhaps embarrassed by the fame he gained, the celebrity, by the publication and success of The Seven Story Mountain, he was also somewhat gratified by it. And he never lost sight of the fact that The Seven Story Mountain also made a pile of money. We don't know how much exactly, but it seems safe to assume that within the first year, by the end of 1949, The Seven Story Mountain had brought into the Abbey of Gethsemane something in the neighborhood of $250,000, which in 1949 was no small sum. It's also true, which was never lost on Merton, that he put the Abbey of Gethsemane on its feet. For some time it had been running in the red. They were still using horses to draw their tractors. They had no product that they sold. And the income from Thomas Merton's writings was used to start what is called Gethsemane Farms. In the early period, the abbot, who, by the way, and I'll be talking more about him, was a graduate of Harvard Business School, felt that you could not run any institution, even a monastery, in the red. And he was determined to put it in the black. And the income from Thomas Merton's early writings helped him to do that. Gethsemane Farms originally produced ham, sausage, and cheese. Later, they dropped the hams and sausages and began making fruitcake. It is, by the way, the best fruitcake I've ever eaten. But the monks are very generous when they pour on the Kentucky bourbon during the aging period. The cheese, I can take or leave. And just to show that Merton never quite lost sight of this, and in a way, he never was too happy with the whole Gethsemane Farms operation. He was never too happy with technology anyway. He was asked to write some copy when Gethsemane first began to produce sausages and hams. And what he produced was this line: "Many porkers are called, but few are chosen to produce our luscious hams." This was not used, and he was never again asked to write for Gethsemane Farms. Some years later, though, he wrote a poem, a takeoff on Joyce Kilmer's Trees, which he entitled Cheese. I'll share this poem with you. "I think that we should never freeze such lively assets as our cheese. The sucker's hungry mouth is pressed against the cheese's caraway breast. A cheese whose scent, like sweet perfume, pervades the house through every room. A cheese that may at Christmas wear a suit of cellophane underwear. Upon whose bosom is a label, whose habitat the Tower of Babel. Poems are naught but warmed up breeze. Dollars are made by Trappist cheese." I think we can divide Thomas Merton's active writing career into two distinct periods. This period in which he produced The Seven Story Mountain and some of his early books of meditations, the one I mentioned yesterday, Seeds of Contemplation, which I think holds up very well today, was a period in which on Merton's journey he conceived that he had found a certain answer. It was definitely a Roman Catholic answer. And at this point in time, he was unable to conceive of any way to God outside the Roman Catholic Church. And going further, outside monasticism, he found it difficult in this period of time to conceive of anyone living a true contemplative life, attempting to find God, except in a monastic setting and in the contemplative life. When one reads the Seven Story Mountain today, there are whole long passages which strike one for their piety in a rather negative sense. He later said, in the 60s, he was writing to a 16-year-old girl in California who had started a correspondence with him. She was one of the few people who ever quite dared to ask Thomas Merton if he rewrote the Seven Story Mountain, how he would rewrite it almost 20 years later. And he responded that he would cut out a lot of the sermons. And in fact, a lot of that had taken place before publication. In the Trappist order, in any religious order at that point in time, as some of you may be aware, they had their own censors, people who read any manuscript and who eventually gave the Nihil Obstat, without which it could not be published. What that meant was that the book was free of moral and doctrinal error. Many observers since have felt that the cutting of the Seven Story Mountain, which the censors insisted upon, was to cut out a lot of the meat of Thomas Merton's story. And one observer even said that the censors castrated the Seven Story Mountain. This is in fact not true, because I have seen the original draft of the Seven Story Mountain, and it was a very long and rambling book with a lot of these pious digressions, or what Thomas Merton would later call sermons, which had little to do with the spiritual journey of himself that he was supposed to be writing about in this book. What the censors objected to was the unwieldiness of it originally. And in fact, many of the censors weren't convinced that he could write very well. One censor advised that he take a correspondence course in English grammar. So that about a third of the Seven Story Mountain was cut before publication. When it came time for the British edition, Evelyn Waugh, who edited it for its British publication under the title of Elected Silence, cut out about another 20%. And Waugh wrote Merton a very stern letter in which he said, "Words are our raw material. If we were carpenters or plumbers or any kind of tradesperson, we would not waste our raw materials. Let me advise you not to waste words." So Waugh too felt that Thomas Merton had been rather wordy in this period. Yet the Seven Story Mountain holds up better than some of his other early writings. He was required by obedience, as it was called, to write a number of things for the Cistercian order. And his abbot required him in this period to write two hagiographies, two biographies of Cistercian figures. The one that was first published was called Exile Ends in Glory, and it was a biography of Mother Mary Birchmans, a Trappistine missionary to Japan. The other one was a biography of Saint Lutgard of Auer, who was a Cistercian nun, and who received the stigmata. In other words, she was stigmatized, received the wounds of our Lord on her own body, in her hands, in her side, and in her feet. Merton, in 1967, did an evaluation of his own books, and he called What Are These Wounds Awful and Exilians in Glory Poor. I would advise you to read these books only after a long and serious study of Thomas Merton, because they are pretty bad. He knew himself. One of the things that makes them really tough going is the narrowness that he displays in these biographies. It's not only a narrowness of Roman Catholicism, but at this point in time, Merton was a racist. He was a chauvinist. In his biography of Mother Mary Birchman's Exilians in Glory, he approves the very hard penances which she was set to perform. She was required, for instance, to wash pigs to prove her humility, to wear bells on her fingers so that she wouldn't gesticulate, to avoid any occasion of laughter. And in this book, Thomas Merton approves this because it is obviously much harder to discipline a woman to the religious life than it is a man. In What Are These Wounds, in talking about Genghis Khan's golden horde, there's an incredible line. One would have thought that a poor, helpless woman, he's talking about somebody, doesn't matter who here, an invalid, totally blind, might have been at least slightly perturbed at the thought of thousands of little yellow men rushing around with swords and setting fire to everything. Well, there's a lot wrong with that passage. It's not very well written. But if you're talking about a woman who's totally blind, she doesn't know whether they're little yellow men or little green men. And yet these are full of this kind of racist attitude. In talking about Mother Mary Birchman's experience in Japan, he referred to the Japanese as pagans, as idolaters, as people difficult to civilize. The kind of thing that, given his later career, is almost incredible. And in fact, he commented later about Exilians in Glory, "Where did I get all that pious rhetoric? That was the way I thought a monk was supposed to write, just after I had made simple profession." So Thomas Merton was later anxious himself to disavow this early period in his life, including the Seven Story Mountain, the book that had put him on the map. Well, what happened to Thomas Merton? It seems clear that he was a person in whom a social conscience had very definitely been awakened before he entered the order. It is probably true that for a period of about a decade, he thought this was the way he was supposed to behave. This was what conversion meant, that he was to turn his back on the world and to be contemptuous of everything in that world. Then when he had his period in the 1950s, the catharsis that came on him in Louisville, and a series of nervous breakdowns in the 1950s, in which I think Thomas Merton was trying within himself to reconcile the existence of some kind of social consciousness with his monastic vocation. Finally, he was gradually able to work this out. Not totally, because for a time in the 50s, during one of these periods of breakdown, he wanted to leave the Cistercian order and go into an order that was even stricter, even more austere, even more disciplined than the Cistercians, the Camaldolese, or the Carthusians. One reason for this was that he continued to want to live in solitude. And this was not, or had not been for centuries, part of the Cistercian tradition. You lived in community. The Cistercians were a cenobitic, or community, as opposed to an eremitic order, where people live more by themselves. Thomas Merton had to struggle in the 1950s to gain some solitude, and he began dinging at his abbot in the 50s to let him have more time by himself. The abbot was resistant because he didn't feel this was part of Cistercian tradition. He did make certain concessions. He appointed Thomas Merton forest ranger for the abbey. Remind me a little bit of some Holden Village type. You know, we have village philosophers, village pastors here. He was the abbey forest ranger, and he was allowed to go out in the afternoons to the fire tower by himself. He was supposed, of course, to be keeping a lookout for fires, but there he could do reading and writing and experience some of the solitude that he wanted. On the other hand, that was another contradiction in Merton. And in 1956, his abbot took him to St. John's Abbey in Collegeville, Minnesota, to an abbot's conference, because he knew that a psychiatrist, Gregory Zilborn, was going to be there. And the abbot felt it would be good for Merton to go through some sessions with a psychiatrist. And this, again, apparently, was part of the catharsis for Merton at this point in time. It was quite traumatic, these sessions with this psychiatrist. But one of the things Zilborn told him in these sessions, that Merton later recorded, was that he had to face the fact that he didn't really want to be a hermit. Zilborn told him that he was the kind of person who talks a lot about being a hermit, but that Merton would be happiest if he had a hermitage in Times Square, so that he could run out, see people, see what was going on, and then when he felt like being alone, run back in the hermitage and say, "I'm a hermit, I'm a hermit, I'm a hermit." And this apparently had some effect with Merton, although he continued to agitate for more solitude for himself. And in typical fashion, just as he wrote the poem Cheese about Gethsemane Farms and the monastic industry, Merton began to publish a variety of articles. He went back into Cistercian history and discovered that in the 11th and 12th centuries, I believe, some Cistercians had been allowed to live alone as hermits. He began to publish articles about this. Merton's method of dealing with anything he conceived as a problem was always to go into print. Some of the articles, one I remember was called Renewal in Eremitism. And he made certain that a copy was placed on the abbot's desk. The abbot continued to resist. Finally, in 1961, the abbot allowed a small cement block structure to be built quite close to the abbey. And the purpose of this building was, it was to be a conference center where Merton could meet away from the abbey proper with the many visitors who by this time were coming to converse with him at the abbey. In 1963, he was allowed to spend his day there. At that point in time, it had no bathroom and no chapel. Purpose of not having a chapel there was that Merton had to come down to the abbey to say mass every day. He wasn't always clear about what the purpose of the outhouse was, and got very nervous. Thomas Merton was always a person who liked nature, except sometimes when he was out in it. And there was a black snake that liked to live in the outhouse. And he records in his journal, Day of a Stranger, when he is talking about his daily routine in the Hermitage, that the day always began by going to the door of the outhouse and saying, "Are you in?" There, you black bastard. And finally, in 1965, Thomas Merton was allowed to retire on a 24-hour basis to the Hermitage. A chapel and bathroom were added. However, Dom James Fox, the abbot, continued to require that he come down to the abbey for the noon meal. The official reason for this was so that Merton would get proper nutrition. Most people feel it was also so the abbot could make sure Merton was there every day and keep some tabs on him. When Dom James retired as abbot in 1968, he retired to a hermitage, a fact that was not lost on Merton. In fact, Dom James' hermitage was built 9 miles away on contiguous abbey property and was later sold as a hunting lodge. That was how nice it was. And Merton commented that he got cement blocks while Dom James got a snappy little hunting lodge for his hermitage. And during this period, while he was agitating for greater solitude, he was beginning to write on all sorts of subjects on which he had not written before. In Thomas Merton's journey, he began to feel this sense of wholeness, this sense of unity with the rest of humankind. And he began to write, as we saw yesterday, on war and peace. He began to write on the racial issue. As Sister Mary Lou Tobin pointed out in the documentary, the thing that really got Merton going with the black-white struggle in the United States was when the bomb was exploded in Birmingham and the children were killed at Sunday school. In fact, for some years, he kept a picture of one of those black children that had been sent to him. And the child was holding a white doll. And Merton had written under the photograph, "She had not yet learned to hate." So let me just share with you quickly here a number of things that Merton had to say about trying to find ourselves and fitting ourselves into this sort of wholeness with the rest of humanity. "If I can unite in myself the thought and devotion of Eastern and Western Christendom, the Greek and Latin fathers, the Russians with the Spanish mystics, I can prepare in myself the reunion of divided Christians. We must contain all divided worlds in ourselves." And again, "And truly, we are so close to ourselves that there is really no relation to the ground of our being. Can we not simply be ourselves without thinking about it? This is true solitude."
Would you do that again, please?
Yes. "And truly, we are so close to ourselves that there is really no relation to the ground of our being. Can we not simply be ourselves without thinking about it? This is true solitude." Is that better now?
Has he used the phrase "ground of our being" as a synonym for God?
Yes, I believe so. Because ultimately God is the ground of our being. Here another one. "In an age when totalitarianism has striven in every way to devaluate and degrade the human person, we hope it is right to demand a hearing for any and every sane reaction in the favor of man's inalienable solitude and his interior freedom. The murderous din of our materialism cannot be allowed to silence the independent voices which will never cease to speak, whether they be the voices of Christian saints or the voices of Oriental sages like Lao Tzu or the Zen masters, or the voices of men like Thoreau or Martin Buber or Max Picard. It is all very well to insist that man is a social animal. The fact is obvious enough, but that is no justification for making him a mere cog in a totalitarian machine, or in a religious one either, for that matter. In actual fact, society depends for its existence on the inviolable personal solitude of its members. Society, to merit its name, must be made up not of numbers or mechanical units, but of persons. To be a person implies responsibility and freedom, and both these imply a certain interior solitude, a sense of personal integrity, a sense of one's own reality, and one's own ability to give himself to society or to refuse that gift." And finally, from his book, Thoughts in Solitude, "In our age, everything has to be a problem. Ours is a time of anxiety because we have willed it to be so. Our anxiety is not imposed on us by force from outside. We impose it on our world and upon one another from within ourselves. Fundamentally, it probably comes to this: living in a silence which so reconciles the contradictions within us that, although they remain within us, they cease to be a problem. Contradictions have always existed in the soul of man, But it is only when we prefer analysis to silence that they become a constant and insoluble problem. We are not meant to resolve all contradictions, but to live with them and rise above them and see them in the light of exterior and objective values which make them trivial by comparison. Merton felt, or came to feel, that we are kept from knowing our true selves or finding our real selves in the ground of our beings through, well, I call them the four A's because they're words that crop up in Thomas Merton all the time. And they all happen to begin with A's. That's why I call them the four A's. Alienation. Now I've forgotten.
Oh, sure.
Anxiety. Annie believes if we can overcome these things, as you saw in the documentary, he said, Christianity revolts against an alienated life. We've had one thing here about anxiety. He also felt apathy was one thing that kept us from our true self, and that very often we are led into the absurd, absurdity in itself. And last week, when we were studying Mark in Bible study, in Thomas Merton's New Testament, which survives in the Thomas Merton Study Center. In fact, we have almost 800 volumes that Merton read himself and in which he made marginal notes and markings. He wasn't supposed to be doing that because those books did not belong to him with a vow of poverty. They belonged to the order. But he was a bad boy and he marked up all these books. But he had particularly marked this section, Mark 7, 20 through 23, which I think rather sums up his attitude about how we deal with ourselves. And he said, Christ, what comes out of a man is what defiles a man. For from within, out of the heart of man, come evil thoughts, fornication, theft, murder, adultery, coveting, wickedness, deceit, licentiousness, envy, slander, pride, foolishness. All these evil things come from within, and they defile a man. So that Thomas Merton felt that we are responsible for what we are. He did not believe that evil comes from outside, a person, but from within a person. And as Christians, if we see an evil and know it is an evil, we can't claim that somebody else made us do it. We did it from within ourselves. So to conclude now my remarks for today, Thomas Merton received many accolades in his life. One finds references to him popping up in places one might not expect. There is quite a long and I think rather good section on him in Martin Marty's book, Pilgrims in Their Own Land, 500 Years of Religion in America, that was published last year, but one would expect to find that in that book. One might not expect to find long references to Merton in Eldridge Cleaver's Soul on Ice. But there, in fact, they are. He said that reading Merton helped him very much get through his first term in Folsom Prison. Lenny Bruce used to introduce one of his routines with a section from one of Thomas Merton's prose poems. Joan Baez has used a poem of Thomas Merton's and set it to music. But I'd like to conclude today with a compliment that was paid Merton by the Quaker activist June Youngblood, who was his link with Martin Luther King and King's movement. She wrote Merton and said, "I can pay you no greater compliment than to use the old Quaker phrase, which was said when the Spirit moved a person to unusual testimony in meeting or extraordinary witness in life. Friend, thee has been used." Let us now pray. This is a prayer that Thomas Merton wrote, which may be his most frequently reprinted item, and which I think sums up a great deal of what he had to say. "My Lord God, I have no idea where I am going. I do not see the road ahead of me. I cannot know for certain where it will all end, nor do I really know myself. And the fact that I think I am following your will does not mean that I am actually doing so. But I believe that the desire to please you does in fact please you. And I hope I have that desire in all that I am doing. I hope that I will never do anything apart from that desire. And I know that if I do this, you will lead me by the right road, though I may know nothing about it. Therefore, I will trust you always, though I may seem to be lost and in the shadow of death. I will not fear, for you are ever with me, and you will never leave me to face my perils alone." Amen. Okay, any questions or comments? Yes.
Can you describe something about the personal freedoms that he had? You know, for a man who's following a rule of silence, it seems like he was talking all the time. And for him also taking a vow of obedience, he was constantly getting around his abbot in a whole variety of ways.
He was trying always to get around his abbot. Let me go to the second one first. Many times he was trying, yes, to get around his abbot. Yet when the abbot actually said, "Do this or do that," Merton did obey. And others, well, the abbot says he was always a very obedient son. That's not in fact true. In the sense that he was always arguing and always at the abbot, maybe, to do some things. And it is also true that some people have trouble with Dom James's role in this relationship. It was a relationship itself full of contradictions, because Merton wrote very harshly about him at times. And Dom James did some things that may strike us as rather petty. When he knew in the 50s that Merton wanted to apply to leave the Cistercians and join another order, Dom James fired off a letter to Cardinal Montini, later Paul VI, who was then Cardinal Protector of the Cistercians, and said that it's full of flowery language. "Our good Father Lewis," he always called him, "is a man given to enthusiasms and extremes, and it is best if he stay here for his own spiritual good." Yet Merton always obeyed Dom James when it came right down to it. And the first part, yes, he was supposed to be silent, but he was writing a great deal. And perhaps I should point out that after Vatican II, the new constitution of the Cistercian order is they no longer observe total silence. They're not supposed to be sitting around yakking and gossiping. They are supposed to speak when necessary or in classes or in conferences. They are supposed to hold talking to a minimum, but they could talk. And the rule of silence was always, well, waved when they went out into the world, for what it was, because it was recognized that you can't very well not talk when you're out there in the world, the rest of us not knowing Cistercian sign language. But yeah, that's a contradiction that he himself saw. He was supposed to be silent, yet he was writing all the time.
And all those visitors. Yeah, that's what I every day you have a host of visitors coming.
Yes, some he wanted, some he didn't.
But he apparently spoke to them.
Yes.
They came to his hermitage. They did not come in silence, just to look or to
Well, if they had appointments or he knew they were coming, he wasn't always... Well, he was bothered and later wanted to look for a place of greater isolation. Some years ago, a couple came into the Merton Center and the man was very interested and was looking around at things, and the woman was standing there rather prune-faced and prim, and I thought, well, she has some problem. And so finally she said, I used to admire Thomas Merton. But I found out he wasn't the man I thought he was. So I didn't say anything. I knew she was going to go on with her story. I could tell that immediately. She said, we discovered where his hermitage was. And we went up through the woods. And she said, we came up behind Thomas Merton. And he was chopping wood or doing something. And he whirled around and said, what in the hell do you think you're doing? And she said, I just don't think a man like Thomas Merton should talk that way. No recognition of the fact that they'd come upon him in the woods had startled him. I'd probably say worse if someone did that to me. Yes?
The question about I'm just wondering if the keeping of Thomas Merton at the Abbey at Gethsemane was not good business. Now, the person that you mentioned, Father Dom
James.
James. Now, he's the one who you said had been in business at.
He was a graduate of Harvard Business School.
And he was.
And he put Gethsemane into business. Yes.
Okay, so that was there a relationship between keeping Thomas Merton there rather than allowing him to go away to another place.
Well, in all fairness to Dom James, I think I would have to say that I think that has two parts. Yes, I don't think he wanted to lose the Cistercian Order's most famous monk.
Yeah, that's revenue for them.
I don't think he did. On the other hand, I think he did sincerely feel that Merton would be best if he stayed at the Abbey for his own spiritual journey. And most observers do feel that without the discipline that was imposed by Dom James and the Cistercian Order, Merton may not have been as prolific and productive as he was. He seemed to have needed that kind of discipline in order to be productive.
I was impressed with, in the Seven Story Mountain, that the recognition was made of his writing skill and ability. That seemed to be his vocation.
Yes, but you see, it was Dom James' predecessor who made that decision. When Dom James became abbot in 1948, the Seven Story Mountain was already a bestseller, and Dom James had a celebrity on his hands already. It's clear that there were times when Dom James would have been just as happy if Thomas Merton never wrote another thing. But that didn't come to pass. He also used Merton. This is the final irony. Merton was Dom James' confessor for 15 years. Okay, any other questions?
When he was in solitude, how much of that time did he spend in reflection and meditation, and how much of it was in working at a typewriter or whatever means he used to get it out?
Well, that's a difficult question because I don't think Thomas Merton ever actually had real solitude. He was never a hermit. There were always too many contacts with the outside world. He says in Day of a Stranger that how I pray is breathe, how I meditate is live. And he came to see his entire life as his prayer. and that most things he was doing were a part of his meditation. So I would take it that even that time at the typewriter, he considered a part of his meditation.
Can I ask, in reference to the thing you read yesterday about the original child bomb, that it was called,
yes.
Where did he get all his facts? It seemed to me that he presented such an insight into each view from everybody, and you know how he was saying things like, and in secret this man said to this man. Where did he get such information? I mean, how does he know so much about it all?
Well, when he became interested in any subject, and I think original child bomb is a good case in point. When he became interested in the dropping of the bomb in Hiroshima, he tried to read everything he could get his hands on about that particular thing. And usually didn't write until he felt he had a total command of the subject.
So,
he got his books, some of them on interlibrary loan. He was writing letters all the time, begging books from people too. Through reading is the way he got his information.
So when he said in secret, I can't remember the quote exactly, but something about in secret, the Japanese sent something to the Russians or something. Was this already a documented fact?
Oh yes. Yes.
Sorry,
yeah. Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you.